Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Andrea Weckerly, and welcome to the Ready Living Podcast, where each episode is designed to educate, inspire, and empower you to create the life you want. My guest today is Barbara Louise Brennan. She's a changemaker, stigma disruptor, workplace mental health solutions expert, and mental health and human rights advocate. She has spent over 15 years transforming the culture of mental health across society, advising influential bodies like the Irish Human Rights and Equality Commission and the Irish National Office for Suicide Prevention. While a leader at Sea Change, Ireland's national stigma reduction program, she championed the iconic Green Ribbon campaign and impacted the global stage through her involvement in the Global Anti-Stigma Alliance. She has lectured at esteemed institutions like Trinity College and Dublin City University, and was awarded the honorary 2024 Outstanding Contribution to Well-Being Award by IBEC and the Keep Well Mark for her work. Having herself recovered from severe mental illness, Barbara is living proof that individuals struggling with their mental health can and do recover. She now runs her own workplace mental health consultancy that guides organizations on policy and procedures, staff awareness campaigns, and mental health champion frameworks, and has earned recognition as an expert in both mental health and corporate sectors. Welcome, Barbara.
Hello.
I guess let's just jump right into it. Today, you're a mental health solutions expert, although my understanding is originally you planned on being an artist and had even opened a craft business at one point. But then the planned trajectory changed after almost losing your life, which is when you shifted from trying to live with mental illness to actively pursuing wellness. Can you please tell us about that?
Absolutely. So I suppose if I go right back, my first experiences of mental health difficulty started when I was in my early teens. And of course, we didn't know that that's what it was, bearing in mind that this was the very early 90s. So there was a lot less known about mental health problems at that stage. There was also a massive amount more stigma, as in stereotyping, prejudice and discrimination. Then, you know, it was seen as much more shameful to have a mental illness, don't mind speak about it. So we didn't know what was going on then. Really, the way we found out that I had a mental illness was that I attempted suicide after my 14th birthday. So that was how we found out that I was struggling. We knew that I wasn't doing great, but being honest, changing schools, doing all the normal stuff, going through hormone changes, everything else, there was a lot of, you know, well, it's just that age, it's a typical time. But the truth is that actually I had lost all kind of pleasure in everything. I had dropped out of all of the social things I was doing. I started slipping from A grades to failing at school. I started completely isolating myself from friends and family and just was deeply, deeply sad all of the time, to such a level that I couldn't function properly anymore. And I think that's the biggest thing that people need to understand, that people can manage mental health problems. It's when the impact is such that it diminishes your functioning is when we really see it as a problem. So I had kind of 14 years of very severe and long-term mental illness. I would have been in and out of hospital an awful lot. I would have been on very, very heavy medications. And then in my 20s, I was re-diagnosed with bipolar disorder 1, which is the more extreme of the two. I've experienced psychosis, for example. So there was a number of different things going on. I also had anorexia and I had alcoholism. So there was a number of different things feeding all of this difficulty, and the symptoms were hard to tell what was what because they were all piling in on top of each other. Those guys make really good friends, you know. And then you've got physical illness on top of that, and you can imagine not sleeping, not being able to function properly because I wasn't eating. So you'd see a lot of these things very, very common and overlapping with depressive disorders, that there are usually other influencing factors as well. And then I suppose it culminated in a suicide attempt that put me on life support in 2008. So that was the most severe attempt that I had in my life, and I was on a machine for a week, so I really shouldn't be here. I died 3 times on the way. I lost half my body weight while I was on that machine, so really my life is a miracle. So I believe that a miracle did happen to me, and I believe that when I woke up, I also would have gone through the detox, because I hadn't been taking the medication during that period. So to be very clear, I'm not against medication, and I highly recommend if somebody wants to come off it, don't do it like that. But the thing is that for the first time in a very long time, I had a clearer mind because I wasn't medicated so heavily. And so I started looking and saying, well, actually, if the best I can hope for is that I'm suicidal every day and I am medicated out of my mind that I can't function, surely there has to be something else. So to be fair, my medical team and my physical well-being team were absolutely phenomenal. I went to the doctor every single day for a number of months. I went on eating programs, on weight gaining programs, on physical therapy programs. I also had to learn how to speak again because I had damaged my throat with the tubes. So there was a lot of very physical things I had to do. But during that time, I also started understanding about neurology and how our brains work and, you know, things like dopamine and serotonin. Like, those words are thrown around, but what did that actually mean? And the impact of serotonin on your sleep, for example, and the impact of daylight. So I live in Ireland, and half of the year we don't have enough light. I started learning about the impact of nourishment. So because I've had an eating disorder, I find the word diet quite restrictive and challenging, actually. So I prefer nourishment or life change or these kind of things. So I started looking at, actually, if I take B vitamins, for example, B6 and B12, they're really good for your blood, but they're really good for your mood. Also, things like understanding your gut health and the GI levels and all of those things. So your sugar levels, if you can get that right, massively impacts your mood. So who knew that sleeping and eating and drinking water and moving your body were the things that I'd heard about all these years and kind of went, yeah, right, that's going to make me better. But actually, I am now 16 years well and healthy, and I've been off medication and I have been phenomenally well. I was told I would never have a proper job because stress was too much. I have run our National Stigma Reduction Programme here in Ireland for 5 years. I now run my own business. I was told I'd never have my own home. Well, I paid off my mortgage 20 years early last year. I own my first 5 Series BMW. So I'm saying those things because they're the tick box that, like, we made it when you've got the nice car and the house and that stuff. But the point is that if I can come back from being suicidal every single day and out of work for 12 years and in hospital 3 to 5 months a year, anybody can do it. And so for me, when I got better, it was that thing of somebody should do something. People are still dying by suicide. People are still becoming incredibly unwell. And it's not okay. It's not enough. So I started knocking on doors and saying, you know what, I got better and here are the things that I did and I'd like to share. And so back in 2009, Sea Change was about to launch. So this was the stigma reduction program. And I was one of the very first volunteers. So I was on TV, I was on the radio, I was in all the papers, and it was about starting a conversation. So that was the beginning of my journey into what I now call accidental activism. I never realized I was an activist until I won an award for that this year. and like that, I'm an educator, which I also didn't realize. And it was just purely that I wanted to make a difference. And how I've got into policy and procedures and those kind of things, it's been working with companies year after year and seeing what works and what doesn't work. And particularly understanding the law from an employment law perspective, from a human rights perspective. And then I've worked on the Assisted Decision Making Capacity Act, which was changed here 18 months ago. So there's a lot of different things feeding into what I do now. And it's about helping people understand it in plain English, in normal language, and also how to access it. So I'm very blessed in the trajectory. And you mentioned the toy making. So where that came from was in 2013, 2 years after getting married, my husband decided he didn't want to be married anymore. And he came home from work and left. And I didn't see him again for 4 years. So in that period of time, I really needed to mind my mental health, bearing in mind I wasn't working at that time. And so I always wanted to learn how to sew. And so I had just had surgeries and had both my feet broken and reset. So I couldn't walk. So I thought, this is a great time to learn how to sew. So I started making toys, and so many people were like, they're amazing, we want one. And it ended up turning into a business. And then I ended up opening a craft shop. And, you know, it just kind of snowballed from there. And concurrently, I was doing my mental health work. And then around 2017, after selling probably about 7,000 sock monkeys, because it was soft toys that I made, I then decided to actually give up the sewing, and the carpal tunnel was very happy about that. So I then went full time into mental health advocacy and training and all of that stuff. So that's my work journey.
Do you still sew on the side then for fun or for friends and family, make little gifts for them?
I do. And it's one of the things that anytime anybody has a baby, they always come to me and they're like, will you make me one of those monkeys and put the name on it? You know, or if my friends have a baby, they know that's what they're going to get. So I used to do sock monkeys, dogs, cats, unicorns, horses. So like little monsters, like any kind of sock creature, I suppose. And yeah, I loved doing it. And it was just something that you could really see children when they really engage properly with them. You know, we made like Batman versions of them and ones with the football emblems, and we made fairies and all sorts. You could really see the imagination. And actually, you could see the parents also engaging their imagination when the children were really switched on. And that was what I loved. So I did do a bit of research around what children need in different stages of brain development and how they play. I'm also very interested in people with disabilities and some of the barriers that they have. So I had actually started developing toys for, you know, people, and also at the end of life, some of the issues that people have from a sensory perspective, how we can improve their brain function.
When you are sharing your story, what I really hear there is a testimony of hope. The idea that you went from very rough and challenging and difficult beginnings where day to day was a struggle to where you are now, it is absolutely astounding. And I love the part where you said that if you can do it, other people can too, and let them know that there is a future waiting for them out there.
Absolutely. And the thing is that it's something I never knew about. You know, I didn't know that people who experience mental health difficulties could get better. I didn't know that they could have a job, that they could be normal, you know. And I think that's a terrible thing, that we other people, that we make them different, that we make them separate. And that's really, when we're thinking about stigma and discrimination, that's really what it is. You're outside of our tribe, you're outside of our community, you're different than us. And that's the thing, that life can be really hard, and then we're adding illness on top, and now we're adding this shame and guilt and othering on top of that. So it's no wonder that people for centuries have hidden the fact that they are struggling with their mental health, aside from how frightening it can be when you're having that experience for the first time. So it does make sense. And for me, it has really been to help people understand that we don't have to be afraid, that we don't have to be afraid of each other, that we don't have to be afraid of the illness, regardless of which one it is, that actually this is a human experience, and that people can get through it, and that they can also find a way, that people are incredibly resilient. And the thing is that most often, for the people that I know who have learned how to live with their illnesses and their disabilities, that actually they're some of the most resilient people that I have ever met, and that they have something to latch onto, and something that some other people have never experienced and may never experience. And it's where my joy and my passion comes from, because I know what it's like when it's not there.
We're using a lot of terms here. And so what I'd love to ask you is to help us understand the difference between mental health and mental difficulties and mental illness. I think that's really important for people to know.
Absolutely. And this is an amazing conversation. So I actually wrote a guide on this in Ireland. It's called Stand Up to Stigma, and it's available on the Sea Change website. And it is exactly for this. So the thing is that mental health is like the topic. So mental health is the overarching theme, if you like. And within that, we have mental well-being. Well-being is when we're functioning well. Mental health difficulties then would be when we're starting to struggle. So maybe, you know, we're not functioning the way we normally are. We're more irritable. We're having a bit of brain fog. Maybe we're not even sure how we're feeling. We're having fluctuating moods or longer low moods. But again, it's the impact. And the thing is that when we see a shift between a mental health difficulty and a mental health illness, or just mental illness, that's when the mental health difficulty has become so impactful that the person isn't able to function normally. It's over a longer period of time, so at least 3 weeks or more. And there are a number of different factors in play where then a diagnosis would be possible. And so this is then where somebody with a mental illness has been diagnosed by a practitioner. So it could be by their GP, so their general practitioner, or it could be by a psychiatrist. It's about the diagnosis. So generally speaking, mental illness is when you've been diagnosed with it. The caveat there is, how many people do you know who don't go to the doctor when they have a cold or a flu or a lump or a bump or whatever? So it is possible to have mental illness and not be diagnosed. So it's just to explain that. But generally speaking, the mental health difficulty, in my understanding, is that it's lower in severity and lower in impact, whereas the mental illness is something that is more lifelong and the impact is higher. More often than not, mental illness needs some kind of treatment or intervention as well. So the like of medication would be more likely in the like of a mental illness. So again, it just depends on the person. But like I said earlier on, I haven't been on medication in a very long time. So whether I am cured of bipolar disorder and some of the other mental illnesses that I've been diagnosed with, I really don't know. But as long as I keep doing the preventative and maintenance stuff, I'm managing to keep my well-being in place. So I think it's helpful for people to understand that we live on this line between 0 and 100. And it's not even that we go up and down the line. It's like a figure eight, that it's kind of more fluid. And it's that kind of piece that we need to remember also, that we don't live down at zero, but we also don't live up at 100. We might live between 50 and 70 maybe. And so if we notice that maybe we've been at 40 for a little while, we need to start recognizing actually what's happening. When was the last time I laughed? When was the last time I had a good night's sleep? When was the last time I really enjoyed the taste of my food? When was the last time that I was comfortable in my own body, that I didn't have tension, for example? Or when was the last time that I really felt at ease? And if we are struggling to answer those questions, it's really important then to start putting things in place to focus on them and practice. And the thing about well-being, we hear this practice all the time, mindfulness practice, meditation practice, well-being practice. It's because we can't get it done. It isn't a destination. It is to improve each day on how we are and how we feel. And so for people who experience either a mental health difficulty or a mental illness, all of those well-being techniques will help, but there may be other things in the toolbox that need to be used as well.
I think that's really important, looking at that spectrum and looking where you are on that spectrum and how you're feeling today, tomorrow, and during the week, and maybe a few weeks, and then deciding, okay, I need to readjust or continue practicing the well-being things that I've already instituted to have a very good quality of life.
Absolutely. And there's two other things there that we need to really catch. As human beings, if we're used to living at 70 and we suddenly find ourselves at 40, we're really mean to ourselves. And we start saying, well, how do I get back to 70? And then we're judging ourselves and we're feeling in even lower because we can't get there. But it's really most often not possible to make that jump. It's too big. So we need to look at 40 and say, okay, it's me and you today. Or maybe 41. What can I do to get to there? And if we consistently make even a 1% effort, it means over a period of time that we're going to get back there. Because the other thing is that it hasn't happened overnight. It's happened over a period of time that we've slipped from 70 to 40. So we need to understand it takes time to build those things back up. So it's really important that we're kind to ourselves in that kind of process as well.
You were talking about stigma earlier, and unfortunately, there's still so much stigma and shame around mental illness. And one of the things being that, because unlike physical illness or injury, mental illness is often regarded as a problem with the person instead of a challenge or problem the person is facing. So even our language usage is imperfect, making it appear that, again, the person is somehow at fault. How do stigma and shame influence the way individuals approach their mental health? And can something as seemingly simple as language make a positive impact?
Absolutely, definitely. And I really love that you have picked this out, because it's one of the things for the last 16 years that I have really helped people focus on. So if, for example, I was to be diagnosed with the flu or with cancer or with diabetes, I would not say, hi, I'm flu, nice to meet you. Or I'm cancer, how are you doing? We'd say, I suffer from, and we go and we get that help. Whereas when we look at illnesses to do with the mind, so if it's schizophrenia, if it's bipolar disorder, if it's depression, if it's anxiety, if it's an eating disorder, we say, I am, he is, she is. You know, she is anorexic, he is schizophrenic, he is depressed. And the thing is that we aren't. I am an illness. you know, I may experience it. It's something that I move through, or it moves through me, but I'm more than the sum of all of my experiences. I'm more than any one characteristic or one experience. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we need to understand, that for some reason, not only do we identify illness in this way as the person, but we also do it with our emotions. I am happy, I am sad. So what you mentioned about the shift in language, even if we were to say, I feel happy, I feel sad, I feel low. Now we're starting to make it slightly separate from that. And also it makes it easier to understand that we can move through it or away from it, or that there's other options there. One of the things that we know from a stigma perspective is that when people experience this kind of language, that, you know, you are the illness, we identify more strongly with it. And what also happens is, in life, we tend to attach to the thing that we're engaging with the most. So for example, if somebody is in work, they're more attached like a glue to the people that they work with, their colleagues, their manager, the jobs that they're doing, the clients, all those things. So when they come out of work, if it's for illness reasons, whether it's for mental health or physical health, we then become more glued and more attached to the health provider or the mental health provider. And we start looking more at the illness and the symptoms, and we start focusing more on that. So the more we focus on all those things, the more entrenched in it we are. And from a stigma perspective, we also know, because of the barriers of shame and judgment and fear, people are less likely to say, well, actually, I'm struggling with my health, or I am feeling low. And that's the piece that we really need to get to. And I think in some ways, the pandemic did give us a gift in that we started seeing each other in a very different way. And we started noticing, you know what, actually, I'm really stressed. Or I'm feeling some kind of something, I don't know what it is, but it's a bit icky and I don't know what to do with it. Or I'm feeling lonely, or I'm feeling stressed, or you know what, I've been down to the supermarket and these people were standing so close to me and I wanted to punch them because I just got so anxious. And we started normalizing all of those kind of feelings. And so that helped us understand that we all experience those. But I think there is still a level of fear around mental health disorders, mental illnesses. So particularly schizophrenia, psychoaffective disorder, bipolar disorder, borderline personality disorder, all of those ones that we don't really understand. And also from a media perspective, when we think historically about what we've seen in the papers and we've seen in the movies, it's usually a psycho killer. But the thing is that we also need to be clear that psychosis and psychopathic are two entirely different things. So we need to understand that the language definitely impacts. The other thing that we know from a well-being perspective, if we think about gratitude for a moment, we start saying how thankful we are. We start giving gratitude to other people, sharing that. It's an uplifting thing. The same is true if we go the other way. If you think about worrying, when we worry, it's paying attention to one thing to the exclusion of all others, which is the definition of mindfulness. It's just with a negative hat on. And so when we go down that route, we tend to be more negative in our self-talk. We also allow that self-critic in. We become lower in our self-confidence, lower in our self-esteem. We're more likely to believe the negative things about mental illness and mental health difficulties. And we're more likely to look for those validating things. So it's, again, heaping more on with this idea of not I feel bad, but I am.
That is really, really, really powerful. And obviously the examples that you were sharing are from the English language. I don't know if you know what it's like in other languages. Do they use the same sort of I am versus it is?
Well, interestingly, obviously I mentioned I'm from Ireland. In Ireland, we would say Tá brón orm, there is a sadness on me. So the thing is that in other languages, we do have this piece of, you know, I have it, or I feel it, or it is on me. So again, it would depend on which language you're looking at. And it is something that we do need to really be cognizant of. And I think as well, particularly, we also need to understand from a stigma perspective, in the Western world, we have moved very much into a space where we're starting to be safer to have these conversations. It's starting to be okay. The whole idea of it's okay not to be okay, it's okay to ask, it's important that we ask. But the thing is that there are still places in the world where it isn't safe to have a conversation, that you could actually be stoned if you're experiencing a mental health problem. Or some countries that don't believe that mental health is actually a thing, that mental illness doesn't exist. So it can be very challenging for somebody if they realize, actually, this is going on for me and it is very real, but my community don't actually recognize this as a real thing. So how do I go and get support, and how do I go and get that? Or if it's a thing that, well, you know, I could be locked up because people are still fearful of this, and maybe it's even against the law. So there's a whole pile of things around culture that we need to be aware of as well, aside from the language piece.
I think back to a few decades ago, at least here in the United States, when someone with mental health issues, let's say depression or anxiety, were told that they have low serotonin and then were very quickly prescribed medication to remedy it. And obviously, as you said, sometimes medication is a solution. I too am not opposed to medication. But while medication can be useful, what we didn't do is look at the life circumstances of the person suffering, perhaps a history of childhood trauma or an unhealthy work environment, a toxic relationship, or the loss of a loved one. And so anxiety, depression in those contexts aren't unusual and instead are a natural, albeit painful, reaction to circumstances. Do we need to change the discussion around causality and mental health issues?
Absolutely. Well, I think that the very first thing that we need to address here is the fact that we talk about negative emotions. Emotions are not positive or negative. They just are. And it's one of the things that when we say negative emotions, usually it's disgust, anger, fear, hurt. You know, all of those things, we experience them and they're very uncomfortable, but they're telling us something. I don't like this. I would rather this. I don't want that. I would rather that. And so it's explaining to us in a way that we feel very, very strongly. It's very visceral. It's very tangible. And it's those things that we need to understand, firstly, about our emotions, that they're telling us something, but also that they're not on their own. So when we think about the psychological way that we work, we have our thoughts, we have our feelings, and then we have our behaviors. So in a cognitive behavioral model, it's really looking at these three things and how they interact. So firstly, understanding that is important. And then secondly, to your point about what's going on for the person. So I mentioned about being holistic earlier on. The other thing that we don't do is, you know, hey, have you had any blood tests done? Maybe your thyroid isn't working properly. Or, you know, maybe there's a disorder in your family that we don't know about that is actually causing you to have, you know, a drop in your blood pressure and maybe your blood sugar. And maybe you get a little bit more irritable when that happens. Or whatever it is, that we don't tend to say, actually, I'm going to go to the GP and I'm going to go get all these things tested and make sure that I don't have some nasty underlying thing or some simple underlying thing that could be fixed by a dietary change or by drinking more water or by possibly having medication. Because here's the thing, if we had cancer, if we had a heart problem, if we had whatever those things are, we would feel more comfortable in taking medication for it and we wouldn't feel ashamed of it. Whereas we still have a thing that actually the mental health problems, well, I should be able to do it on my own. I shouldn't need that. So there's two things there. And then to your point about the impact of other things. So we also have this historical shame, you know, it's a matter of, oh, well, we don't talk about that. If I go back even two generations to my grandparents, you don't air your dirty laundry. You don't tell anybody else. Keeping up with the Joneses comes to mind. You know, we put on this front. So we've heard about the mask before. You know, societally, it's not allowed. You keep all of that stuff to yourself. And it's why also, and particularly in Ireland, we have this thing. We have about 1,000 ways of asking how you are. And yet, God forbid somebody might actually tell you. So usually when you meet somebody on the street, hi, how are you doing? How's it going? And the person keeps walking. And sometimes when other cultures come to Ireland and they hear this, they're standing there waiting to respond and the person is gone. And they're saying, well, what happened? I didn't get a chance to respond to you.
It's the same in the United States. Hi, how are you? But nobody expects an answer. And if you do give an answer, it's exactly what you described. It's like, well, why are you saying something beyond, hey, I'm okay?
That's it. So we also expect the person to say that they're grand, they're fine, they're okay, whatever it is. And actually, particularly fine, I use that a lot. So in some of the corporate talks and different things that I do, I say to people, well, when you say fine, do you know what that stands for? FINE. And obviously I get the blank look and I say, so I'll use the clean version, fearful, insecure, neurotic, and emotional. So the next time somebody asks you how you are, I want you to say, am I fearful, insecure, neurotic, and emotional? So here's the thing. I mentioned I was a suicide survivor earlier on. As a suicide survivor, is fine all that you really want in your life? Is that good enough? And the second thing is, this is the beginning of having different conversations. If we can say, I'm fair to middling, I'm doing okay, I've had better days, I'm awesome, I'm having a great day. Whatever it is, if we could actually just describe it, I'm not saying spill your guts and tell them everything, but literally just describe how you are and leave it at that. Firstly, it puts down the weight of having to carry, I am everything, keeping up with the Joneses, I am perfect on the outside, struggling with all the stuff. But the other gift that we have then is that we are allowing the other person do the same thing. And it means that that person is more likely over time to possibly talk to us if they are struggling. And that's the thing that I have found the most, that the more open I am, and I don't mean giving away everything that's happening or spilling my guts every time, but when I'm honest with people, or even at the start of a meeting, when people say, oh, how are you? And I might say, actually, I'm not feeling so great today. I'm here for it. I'm absolutely capable of doing my job, but I'm not in great form. And leaving it at that, it just allows a different conversation. And then sometimes it also means that if, for example, I'm in that meeting and I'm a little bit snarky, if I've already said, look, I'm not in great form, if I'm a little bit snappy today, it's nothing to do with you. The person is not going to be snarky back, or they're not going to go home offended or upset. Whereas if I hadn't said anything, they could actually leave that room saying, I don't know what I've done. She's really angry with me, or she's not normally like that. And then the questioning starts. So the language that we use is massively impactful, but also it has a huge long-term effect on our relationships and how people engage with us and how safe they feel with us. So I think that's another piece of the stigma, that when we really look at that, and then also around the circumstances piece, that somebody might be more likely to tell us a little bit about maybe why they're feeling, or maybe that something happened years ago. And you know what? I know that has nothing to do with what's happening now, but it's kind of coming up for me at the minute and I feel something about it. So sometimes that piece before we jump into trauma or any of those things can be really, really important. So obviously for anybody who's listening who has experienced any kind of trauma, and it doesn't matter what that is, the point that we're talking about here is the impact. If somebody is still feeling impacted by their trauma, whether it was 2 minutes ago, 2 years ago, or 25 years ago, if it's still impacting you, if it is still having negative ways of showing up in your life, if it is still driving you in such a way that you feel fearful or anxious or angry or whatever those feelings are, I would really encourage you to get some support and get some help in working your way through that and putting some more protective mechanisms in place. And again, that's that piece of maybe cognitive behavioral therapy, working out what those triggers are and knowing when I go to this place, that really bothers me. And so maybe I need to prepare a little bit more because I have to go there because maybe my family live there or whatever it is. Or maybe it's, a particular smell or a sound, or we don't know sometimes, but here's what I'm going to do if I feel that way in the future. So I think looking at the circumstances is a huge part, and then managing the symptoms is the other side of it. And then there's the life stuff in the meantime. So I mentioned earlier about how we live. So if somebody has been unwell for a period of time and they're not sleeping well, and then they start going to bed later and later and later, and then it's better, well, I have insomnia, whatever. But if we don't make ourselves rest, and if we don't allow ourselves to have those routines, it's probably not going to make it any easier to get better. In the same way, I mentioned that I had an eating disorder. For all of the years that I just put it down to, oh, well, that's just the way I am, I didn't make a big enough effort to change it. And so some of those things, it's not that I'm saying it was on me, but at the same time, when I started making those changes and I started addressing those circumstances and I started addressing my behaviors, actually, some of those things, those behaviors, I suppose, I built them to keep me safe at a time when I was very unwell, but they didn't help as I got better. And so I had to learn new ways to cope. And I think that's one of the biggest things. we change as human beings and as who we are over time. And just because I was letting go of those behaviors doesn't mean that that was a bad thing. And I think that's really important for people to hear, that it's okay to let go of certain behaviors and it's okay to let go of difficult things. It doesn't mean that you're forgetting it. It just means that you're not reliving it anymore.
Do you think that there's an increase in mental health problems in the last couple of years, let's say the last decade or so? Or do you think that we're just really talking about it more? Because it seems that it's more in the news, it's more in the media, certainly prominent figures, celebrities talk about it. And so some people are thinking that, oh my goodness, there's this wave of everybody has mental health problems. What's your take on that?
I actually think it's both. So what I'll say is that firstly, we have massively more understanding about neurodiversity now, around mental health problems now, around physical illnesses now. So we're starting to understand, even from a scientific perspective, actually what's going on. And then from the perspective of talking about it more, the fact that we are talking about it more, of course, we're going to become more aware. But the thing I definitely will say is, I think that if we look back again, going back just two generations or even one generation, the pace of life has completely shifted. You know, we had a very much different way of living. So you went to work, you came home, you had time to rest. You had a circle of friends. You most often had a community. You know, there was a lot more faith-based activity then. So people have become a lot more insular and isolated. And for people like me who don't have children, it means that I'm not meeting all the moms down at the soccer pitch, or, you know, I'm not shopping at the same time as they are, or I'm not doing the carpooling or standing outside the school gates. And so there are a whole pile of things that are missing. And for people who don't engage with faith, it means that they're missing that element. Firstly, from a faith perspective, they don't have that support. And then secondly, from the human connection. You know, I'm sitting in a room with other people and maybe I don't know them, but even to nod to, you know, the lovely gentleman that I see every Sunday, it's, hi, how are you doing? How's your wife? And we just move through those conversations. It's the same way when we get a cup of coffee, we might have a chat, or the person in the supermarket, we might have a chat. When we remove all those things, it has a big impact on us. So I think there's a lot around the cultural issues. There's a lot also around displacement, that there's been a lot more movement across the world in the last number of years. Financially, people are under a lot more pressure now. Also, if you look at nutrition, you know, the impact, if you look at human bodies 50 or 60 years ago and the way they are now, the amount of processed food that we're taking, the amount of sugar that we're taking, and this is no judgment, by the way, it's just a matter of, if we were physically living the way we were 50 years ago, we were eating very differently and we were moving our bodies more. You know, we had more simple foods, so our bodies could process them more. We also tended to eat things that were grown locally and produced locally. So there was a lot less of, you know, things being sprayed with chemicals and pesticides because it wasn't mass produced. So all of those things have a massive impact on our mental health. And I think those are the things that we don't really realize. We also have seen a huge impact on people's mental health with understanding now things that are happening all the way across the world that we never knew about. You know, the news in any country is available at my fingertips every single second. I'm getting bombarded from all these different social media, everything. You know, we have children of very young ages starting to understand things that adults still can't wrap their heads around. So from all of those perspectives, of course, we're going to be more challenged with our mental health. And it's happening younger and younger without having those support mechanisms in place, or, you know, understanding behavior things and how we can give children tools to develop that side of them as fast as their fear is developing, as fast as their knowledge is developing, as fast as their understanding of all these cultural things are developing. We're not giving them the tools to process them. And so those also impact. And then there's also then the access to alcohol and drugs. So aside from the sugar and all the other things. So there's so many different things now that impact the way that we live. And I think that they all individually are part of the story and the piece. And that's before we talk about the access to mental health supports. We're talking about it more, but I do think that the way we live is definitely impacting as well.
You raise some good points, especially about exposure to news and media. So one of the things I've started doing is being very intentional about how I consume the news and when I consume it. I'm somebody who wants to be informed, and I take pride in that. I don't want to not know what's going on in my local community, nationally and internationally. I think that's part of being an informed citizen. But I also know that on many occasions, I've gone too far and harmed myself by exposing myself to details of horrific things that are happening without having a buffer that allows me to process that. And then for hours, I'd be sidelined by that. So what I do now is I'm intentional about the news sources I look at. Definitely stay away from misinformation, disinformation sources, hateful outlets. I prefer very often to consume news in a written format because it gives me greater control than looking at a video of something where obviously my emotions are going to be pulled in differently. That doesn't mean I never look at video news sources. Sometimes it's very beneficial. But again, being very intentional about my consumption and the impact it's going to have on me.
I think that is so important. And it is one of the things that actually about 20 years ago, maybe slightly longer, when I was really trying to make a difference in my life, it was one of the things that I said, you know what, I'm not going to watch violent movies anymore. The news is too much for me. I feel that I need to personally contribute when somebody is suffering. And so when I'm watching things about war or starving babies or these different things, it absolutely breaks my heart. And it hurts me so much that I feel like I can't function. So it's really important for me to be very mindful of those things. So I think it's really important that people hear the word intentional there. So it's not that it's saying don't do it. It's about saying doing it intentionally. And the other thing I heard you say was buffer. So if I'm going to do it, what do I have in place to help me regulate again? And that's the piece. What mindful way can I approach this?
I read somewhere that you're a mindfulness practitioner. Can you share with us how mindfulness helps you and how you learn to do it?
Absolutely. So I'll give you the funny bit first. So how I learned to do it, well, this was going back to when I would have been in hospital and doing, you know, lots of different treatments and different things. And they brought us down to do these different programs, I suppose. And I really hated it. Oh my goodness. It was so stressful. It made me so much more anxious. It made me just really want to smack the person who was trying to get me to do it. You know, it made me feel like I really couldn't function and that I was a proper failure. So that was my first experience. And interestingly, I think a lot of people feel like that because we've been sold this idea that it's zen-like, that it's incredibly peaceful and that, you know, like close your eyes and breathe. And, you know, and the thing is, yes, when we do those things, we can achieve that. But the thing is that when we're not taught how to practice it from a young age, stillness is not something that we're comfortable with. We've already talked about the media and the pace of life. So now I'm going to also add the guilt of I'm going to sit here for 20 minutes and do absolutely nothing. You know, the washing machine still needs to be emptied. The shopping needs to be done. The food needs to be put on the table for the kids. I still have 2 hours of work to do. You know, I have 14 friends I haven't seen in 2 months. Make the list as long as you like. So we have this idea, firstly, that it's selfish. So we have to get past that. So for me, approaching all of those things and then bearing in mind that when I was experiencing very high levels of mental illness, my sensory perception was completely off. And so what I mean by that is that a sound could sound a lot more vibrant or a lot more threatening or would go through me physically, that I could physically feel it. Smells, for example, might be very overwhelming, or taste. One of the things that I was asked to do in a mindfulness session was to eat a raisin, to feel the texture of it and the flavor of it. And it totally freaked me out, bearing in mind I also had an eating disorder. So the whole point with some of these things is to find a practitioner that will help support you, that if you do have some of those challenging things, that you can work your way through it. And it's not about push through it anyway. The biggest thing about mindfulness to understand, and I mentioned this already earlier, it's paying attention to one thing to the exclusion of all others. And this is the way that we get to that place of Zen. So this idea of the monkey mind and jumping in, and the idea of using our breath. We see these images of Buddhist monks or just people who are meditating and they're very still and they look very, very calm. We can all achieve that, but it's about allowing ourselves find the way to it. So what I found helpful was that monkey mind. And what I mean by that is you're sitting and you're starting to, you know, inhale. So feel the breath. Is it hot? Is it cold? Where is it going? We're not changing it. So just being curious. a body scan for me is really, really helpful. This is where I actually imagine the breath going down my throat, going down my spine. Oh, maybe it's stopping here at my collarbone. Maybe I need to release the tension there a little bit, just focus a little bit. And even just, wiggle my shoulders, wiggle my fingers, whatever it is. I feel for me, a very physical sensation is really helpful to become more mindful, being intentional on purpose in the moment. The other thing is that then when, did I turn the iron off? Or what time is it? Dinner has to be ready because my partner's going to be home soon. Okay, mind, thank you for reminding me that. It's okay, you're not going to forget. We can come back to that in 2 minutes. We're just going to focus back again. So then bringing it back to, is my breath hot or cold now? And just repeating it. And it can feel really irritating to keep on repeating and repeating. And you can feel like a buzzy bee hopping from one thing to another. But that's absolutely okay. And it's about the practice. The more we practice it, the more muscle memory our body will get. So the more that we do it, the faster your brain will go, I recognize this. I know what she's doing. I need to start relaxing those muscles. And actually, this is the fascinating thing from a neuroscience perspective. If we live in that real fight or flight piece, cortisol is heightened in our body. So one of the things that we see quite a lot is people that have stomach issues. That actually, if I'm in fight or flight, my digestive system has shut down because do I need to run away from this lion or tiger or bear, or do I need to digest the meal I've just had? So if I'm constantly in fight or flight, things like digestion and also muscle tension, if I need to run as fast as I can, my body needs to be ready to do that or ready to fight. And so my muscles are much tighter. So all of these things have an impact on how we relax. So that's really important to remember that when we're trying meditation for the first time or we're trying mindfulness for the first time, there's different ways to get to it. It might be through sound. It might be a guided meditation. It might be running water. It might be physical touch. So for me, I normally wear rings or I'll focus on what is the texture of this thing I'm wearing or the seat. I remember sitting on a bus and this was probably about 20 years ago, and the seats were really scratchy and really uncomfortable. And I remember sitting there and rubbing the seat. And unfortunately, I put my hand slightly too far under and I found chewing gum under there. That was horrible. But the texture, it really brought me in the present. And in that moment, it let go of my anxiety of being on a bus of crowded people. So those are some of the ways that we can get in there. And there is so much on YouTube. There is so much online with how to practice. And it's just that, just to remind yourself it's a practice and it's okay. And it's not to get it done. It's not for it to feel any particular way. It's to just still your body, to bring relaxation into your body. And if your mind is thinking away in the background, it's okay. And it's more to ask it, what is it that you're worried about right now? And maybe can you sit with me? And it's like inviting this other person to say, do you know what? I see that you're trying to keep me safe by giving me all this stuff so I won't forget. We're not going to forget. Would it be helpful maybe actually if I wrote these things down? So I'm going to take a minute. I'm going to pause for my mindfulness. I'm going to write them down. And now I'm going to invite you to come back. Can you give me a minute? I've given you a minute. So can you give me a minute? So some of those really, really simple things, I think, are the way to access this different practice.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I especially liked what you said about the mind. The mind is there to help us, and sometimes it overreacts to situations. And so, as you noted, thank the mind, say thank you. Thank you for what you're telling me. I will get back to you later on that, or I took note of that and we'll address it later. Right now, I need to relax and do X, Y, and Z. So, I think that's a very, very useful approach that I've used myself.
And we're safe. Because most often that peace is coming from fear, it's showing up in anxiety. But all we need to do is, I hear that you're trying to keep me safe, and I think we're okay. I think we're okay. I've got us. And that really can help that just lower down in intensity just a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. You've worked with the National Office of Suicide Prevention and the Mental Health Commission and the Health Service Executive, which is the publicly funded healthcare system in Ireland, in relation to the Mental Health Capacity Act and relative training. How have your own experiences informed your ability to understand the needs of people with mental health challenges and how best to support them?
So I mentioned earlier on that I was involved in a book related to the Assisted Decision Making Capacity Act. And so how I got involved with that was there was a survey being done to understand the experiences of people with lived experience of mental illness and particularly hospitalizations. And so my conversation started with helping the health service executive or the HSE to understand what capacity looks like and what it feels like when you're the person receiving the service. So what they've done is they've really looked at capacity to understand when is it that somebody is deemed to not have capacity anymore so that they don't understand or they can't make a decision. So some of the kind of examples that they use in their training is maybe a small child who's going to the dentist. Do they understand what's about to happen? Do, you know, maybe they're getting a tooth out and they have to have a little injection. Do they understand that this injection, it's going to be a chemical that's put in, that they're going to feel a pinch from the injection, and that it's going to feel a little bit funny and they might feel a bit woozy. And then when they come out of the dentist, that tooth is going to be gone maybe. So they need to have it explained in a very simple way. Or maybe if it's somebody who's experiencing dementia, that, you know, if they're in early stages, it doesn't mean that they're in that stage of not having capacity all of the time. They may have periods where they understand and they're very, very cognitively functioning. So it's about understanding, firstly, what is it that deems a person not to have capacity or not to understand, and how long is that for? But also the more important bit for me was a matter of, you know what, even if I'm deemed not to have capacity, I'm still a human being and I still know, even if I don't understand what's going on, I still know I prefer to be treated with kindness. I still know that I prefer to be involved in my care and my treatment. So even if I don't have capacity to make a decision right now, I'd like you to help me understand what you're deciding for me. And I'd like you to be nice to me while you're doing it. So it's that piece, because quite often what happens, and particularly when we think of wards of court or people who have been put into an institution against their will, some of those pieces can get lost because we get looking at how to keep the person safe and we get looking at the law. So you've now got the psychologist, psychiatrist and the solicitor all talking about what's going to happen to this person instead of doing it with the person. And I think that's one of the biggest things that we need to look at. We don't want to do anything to a person. So nothing about me without me. We want to do it with the person. And that's really a lot of what I've done. So in relation to this, I supported the HSE in building a piece of training. And through conversations that we had, they then developed this training that was rolled out to 90,000 staff. And it's actually on their HSE learning platform. And so my story and my voice are included in that. And it's really helping people understand, you know, I don't want to have to explain my story every single time I go to care because your staff have changed. They should take the time to read my file, you know, and maybe if they need to check in on something, that's fine. But I shouldn't have to repeat my story every single time because maybe actually I don't want to remember all of that trauma. So that is a really big piece. Or maybe if you realize that I am slightly distant today or slightly distressed, maybe it might be nice to say, can I get you a glass of water? Would you like a cup of tea? Be human. And actually, you know what? Maybe we're going to sit for 5 minutes before we get started so that we're helping that person to regulate themselves again. So it's some of those things that when we're thinking about how can we support another person, it's about actually, how can I empower you in this situation to do the best for yourself?
You really beautifully described some of the key elements of an effective support system for an individual. And I want to look at the other side of that. If you are supporting somebody with mental challenges or mental illness in their journey towards mental well-being again, that can be very emotionally demanding. How important is it for supporters to seek their own support? And what resources or strategies do you recommend as being most effective for maintaining their own well-being?
It's absolutely massive. It's so important. So there's two different things that I would highly recommend for people to look at from a point of view of support. So first of all, and I'll put this in the context of my family. So I am very lucky that my family were incredibly supportive to me, incredibly kind, incredibly loving, and we have a very, very close relationship. And so I was always supported, even when I was very unwell. And sometimes I will be honest that when people are very unwell, and it definitely happened to me, I was unpleasant to my family. I was unkind. I said horrible things. And then we have the thing of, you know, teenagers do that anyway. So first of all, it's the piece about getting support around any anger or resentment that we might have from a parental point of view or a carer's point of view or a supporter's point of view. And then there's also the thing of, you know what, I can see that this person really, really needs this help. They really need to do X, Y, and Z. So we need Barbara to eat. We need her to go to bed and sleep. We need her to drink water. She is refusing to eat. She's staying up until 4 o'clock in the morning. I want to strangle her. You know, I want to kick her ass and make her do this stuff. Why can't she just do those things? So that can be really challenging to know that the person that you are supporting would be better if they did some of these things, or that they're refusing to go and get help or support, or if they're not taking their medication or whatever those things are. So first of all, it's the looking at actually, it's okay to have those normal responses. Those negative feelings we talked about earlier, they're not negative. They're telling you that you would prefer it to be a different way. That's normal. The other part that's behind that also is our human judgment. You know, we don't like it when things feel unsafe. We don't like it when we are angry. We don't like it when we're challenged. And so we have judgments about those things. And sometimes it also isn't helpful when we interject those things into the conversation with the person we're supporting. And that can be challenging. So it's about getting help with that. And then it's about getting help with the, you know what, I feel deeply sad that I can't help. I can't fix it for this person that I deeply care about. So I would highly recommend for a person to go and get support, whether that's counselling, whether it's psychotherapy. So psychotherapy is that piece about talk therapy, but it can be more helpful sometimes in that it looks at cognitive behavioral therapy, for example, or it gives practical things. So some of the things that people don't realize is that if I go to a counselor, they aren't necessarily going to give me any answers. So depending on the kind of talk therapist I go to, I need to understand that some people will just sit there and listen, and they might ask a few questions, but they probably won't. They're just going to leave it to me. And so it isn't solution focused, and it doesn't really give me the tools. So it can be really important to understand the different kinds of therapies there are, and then what might be the most helpful for you. And then that piece, actually, when the person you're supporting is at a place where they can engage, doing things like family therapy can be really helpful. And this is where the family would go together and have a facilitator to facilitate some of those difficult conversations. You know, like, you know, you're doing this thing that's really challenging, and I want to strangle you. And also, because there's stigma, I can't talk to my friends about this, so I'm twice as angry as I should be, and I'm finding that really difficult when I know you're unwell and I'm really struggling. I love you so much, but I want to smack you right now. You know, so it's important that we're able to say those things in such a way that isn't super challenging to us, but also isn't massively hurtful to the other person, if at all possible. And that's where that facilitator comes in. So it's important that we have different ways of dealing with it. And then the other side is the physical health. So we talked about the impact on our mental health. You know, parents and carers and supporters all have their own mental health too. So it's really important to look after your own mental health in the ways of, you know, is it mindfulness? Is it taking a bath? Is it taking the time out to say, actually, I am exhausted, and I know that you need X, Y, and Z, but actually, I need to do this first, and I can do that for you, but I'm not doing it until tomorrow. So it's absolutely okay to put boundaries in place. So I think that that is the other side, from a point of view of learning maybe new skills, that can be really important from a supporter's perspective. And again, there are lots of organizations that provide family support and those kind of things, but boundary setting is a really important skill to learn, I think.
Given that we spend so much time at work, it's crucial to foster a positive mental health culture within our organizations. And I know you've done a lot of work in this area. I'm thinking that a well-crafted mental health policy not only keeps organizations compliant, but also ensures that workplace is a safer and healthier space for everyone. Clearly, compliance is country-specific, but can you give us some general guidance on what a strong employee-friendly policy might look like?
I left SeaChange last year and I set up my own business called Mental Health Matters, which is really exciting. And I've just gone limited company, which is also very exciting. And the reason that I've done this is because I want to be able to provide better services for organizations. How do we do training? How do we keep people safe? How do we provide reasonable accommodations? A lot of organizations understand health and safety from a perspective of slips, trips and falls and physical illness. And so we have sick policies in place so that if somebody, let's say, has has an accident or somebody has a disease or a physical illness, we have things in place and measures in place. So we might have a policy that will tell us, well, you're allowed to have 20 days a year and we're going to pay for those. And, you know, maybe we're going to send you to Auch Health as well, or maybe we've got a doctor on site, or maybe that's up to you and you have to do that. And when you're coming back in, there's going to be a certification to say that you're healthy to return, and we're going to do a return to work process so that we're limiting exposure and possibility of you relapsing, or you really struggling with something different when you come back because you've been out for, let's say, 4 months. So there's a couple of different things that happen already. And then, like I said, with slips, trips and falls, we do risk assessments. So we have a whole pile of things in those instances. So with mental health, we now have psychosocial risk assessments in place. So this is understanding, actually, is our work environment psychologically safe? And psychosocially, is it safe? So from a point of view of a person's individual well-being, and also from an environmental perspective, so is it that we have a toxic culture and people are, you know, really butting off each other and there is a really negative attitude and negative environment all the time? That would wear somebody down. And if that's not dealt with, that actually can fall into the piece of psychosocial risk. And so then it could be more likely, for example, that we're starting to see cases where an employee has taken a suit against their employer for psychosocial issues because of damage that was done for something that happened to them while at work. Or also, if we think about workload, that can be another thing that can impact and can have psychosocial risk. So if somebody is consistently under impossible workloads and impossible deadlines that is just not possible to reach or reduce, obviously you're more likely to see burnout in those instances. So some of the kind of cases that we've seen in the last number of years that are really changing the landscape here are when an employer had an employee doing a job and the employee went out of work for a mental health difficulty. And so they're out of work for a period of time and they then came back to the same job. Nothing had changed. And so obviously the stress remained the same, the issues remained the same, and the person went out of work again. At this instance, because the employer was aware of the issue, they were aware of the impact on the person and they did nothing, that employee actually won that case and they were able to take a suit there and were successful in it. So the thing is that when we're looking at employment law, for example, we have things like our human rights coming in there, and then also from an employment law. So we have the right to disconnect now. I don't have to be online all the time. We have the right to, you know, time off. We have the right to a safe environment to work in. So there's a lot of different things that we have from a human rights perspective that also come in under the employment law. And then we've got the health and safety pieces. So there's a lot of different things that come together, and a lot of those are in place regardless of country or jurisdiction. And then, as you mentioned, there may be additional things. So, for example, in Australia, they have been leading the charge for a long time and they have mandatory mental health policies in place. So that's really looking at how do we do this in such a way that we're really supporting people in a very, very clear way. So the thing that I do very much is looking at how do we look at the supports that we have in place. How do we look at maybe crafting a mental health policy specific to mental health? We might bring in stuff from the sick leave policy or the diversity and inclusion policy or the dignity at work policy. But then it's actually more important to say, well, what's the procedure that goes with this? What are the forms that need to be filled in? Who's going to know? For example, is there a disability passport? So this is where if you are unwell and you need reasonable accommodations, that maybe a document is drafted and it's between you and your manager and maybe you and HR because they need to help to implement it. But what happens if your manager leaves? So a little bit like going to the doctor and having to say your thing all over again, this time your new manager now will get that passport and they'll be able to say, okay, so Barbara has this reasonable accommodation in place to be able to go to her doctor once a month. That's absolutely no problem. That's already been approved. That's something that's in place. I can see that a review of that is due in 2 months. That's no problem. And there's the form that we need to fill in together. So again, it's about the practicality of those things and the communication of it. Because what I do see is a lot of organizations who might have a great policy, they might have great procedures, they might have amazing reasonable accommodations, they might have employee assistance programs even, or EAP. Nobody knows what they're for. Nobody trusts them. there isn't transparency around it, and people don't know how to access it. So some of it is around what's in place, and some of it is about the accessibility.
Yeah, no, I mean, what you're sharing is all very encouraging. There's obviously room for improvement, but thinking back over the developments over the past couple of decades, we're really moving in the right direction, and I'm super excited about that. And so I just want to remind our listeners out there, if you're enjoying today's Ready Living podcast episode, please consider subscribing so more people can discover it and also benefit from the valuable insights guests like Barbara share with you. And finally, Barbara, how can people get in touch with you if they're interested in learning more about your super important, valuable work?
Absolutely. So I'm Barbara Louise Brennan on LinkedIn. They will also find me on Instagram and Facebook. My website currently is barbaralouisebrennan.ie, and mentalhealthmatters.ie is launching later this month as well. I also am excited that they will be able to find me in LinkedIn Learning. My first LinkedIn Learning course is landing in time for World Mental Health Day this year. And that is looking at an 8-step framework for HR, people leaders, or anybody interested in well-being in the workplace. So they can find me both in LinkedIn Learning and on my LinkedIn profile as well.
Wonderful. Barbara, thank you so much for having taken the time today.
It's been absolutely my pleasure.